Chapter 47. Larry and Leo were sitting on the curb in front of the house. Larry was drinking a warm Ham's beer, Leo a warm orange spot. From out back came the steady, gruff roar of the lawn boy. Lucy was cutting the grass. It was the last day of August. Larry had offered to do it, but Lucy shook her head. Find out what's wrong with Leo if you can. The day after Nadine had moved in with Harold, Leo hadn't appeared for breakfast. Larry had found the boy in his room, dressed only in his underpants, his thumb in his mouth. He was uncommunicative and hostile. Larry had been more frightened than Lucy because she didn't know how Leo had been when Larry had first encountered him. His name had been Joe then, and he had been brandishing a killer's knife. The best part of a week had passed since then, and Leo was a little better, but he hadn't come back all the way, and he wouldn't talk about what had happened. That woman had something to do with it, Lucy had said, screwing the cap onto the lawnmower's tank. Nadine? What makes you think that? Well, I wasn't going to mention it, but she came by here the other day while you and Leo were trying the fishing down at Cold Creek. She wanted to see the boy. I was just as glad the two of you were gone. Lucy, she gave him a quick kiss, and he had slipped his hand under her halter and given her a friendly squeeze. I judged you wrong before, she said. I guess I'll always be sorry for that. And I'm never going to like Nadine Cross. There's something wrong with her. Larry didn't answer, but he thought Lucy's judgment was probably a true one. That night up by King Super's, she had been like a crazy woman. And have you noticed how white her hair is getting? Larry nodded. He had. Now, half an hour after that discussion, he drank his hams and watched Leo bounce the ping-pong ball he had found the day the two of them had walked up to Harold's, where Nadine now lived. The small white ball was smudged, but still not dented. Thock, 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 against the pavement. Bouncy, bouncy ball, Lee, look at the way we play. You want to go fishing, kiddo? Larry offered suddenly. No fish, Leo said. Do you know Mr. Ellis? Sure. He says we can drink the water when the fish come back. Drink it without... He made a hooting noise and waved his fingers in front of his eyes. His seawater green eyes were fixed on Larry's. Without boiling it? Yes. Thock, thock, thock. I like Dick, him and Lori. Always give me something to eat. He's afraid they won't be able to, but I think they will. Will what? Be able to make a baby. Dick thinks he may be too old, but I guess he's not. Larry started to ask how Leo and Dick had gotten on that subject, and then didn't. The answer, of course, was that they hadn't. Dick wouldn't talk to a small boy about something so personal as making a baby. Leo had just known. Thock, thock, thock. Yes, Leo knew things, or intuited them. He hadn't wanted to go in Harold's house and had said something about Nadine. He couldn't remember exactly what. But Larry had recalled that discussion and had felt very uneasy when he heard that Nadine had moved in with Harold. It had been as if the boy was in a trance, as if... Thock, thock, thock. Larry watched the ping-pong ball bounce up and down, and suddenly he looked into Leo's face. The boy's eyes were dark and far away. The sound of the lawnmower was a far-off, soporific drone. The daylight was smooth and warm. And Leo was in a trance again, as if he had read Larry's thought and simply responded to it. Very casually, Larry said, "Yes, I think they can make a baby. Dick can't be any more than 55 at the outside. Cary Grant made one when he was almost 70, I believe." "Who's Cary Grant?" Leo asked. The ball went up and down, up and down. Larry thought, "Notorious, North by Northwest." "Don't you know?" he asked Leo. "He was that actor," Leo said. "He was in Notorious and Northwest." North by Northwest, Larry thought. "North by Northwest, I mean," Leo said in a tone of agreement. His eyes never left the ping-pong ball's bouncing cores, and Larry was reminded eerily of Tom Cullen and his elephant. "That's right," he said. How's Nadine, Mom, Leo?
She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her.
Oh.
It's bad now. It's bad with both of them.
Nadine and... Harold, he thought.
Yes, him.
They're not happy.
He's got them fooled. They think he wants them.
He?
Him.
The word hung on the still summer air.
Thock, thock, thock.
They're going to go west, Leo said. Jesus, Larry muttered. He suddenly felt the old fear sweep him. Did he really want to hear any more of this? It was like watching a tomb door swing slowly open in a silent graveyard, seeing a hand emerge. Whatever it is, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know it.
Nadine, Mom, wants to think it's your fault, Leo said. She wants to think you drove her to Harold. But she waited on purpose. She waited until you loved Lucy, Mom, too much. She waited until she was sure. It's like he's rubbing away the part of her brain that knows right from wrong. Little by little, he's rubbing that part away. And when it's gone, she'll be as crazy as everyone else in the West. Crazier, maybe.
Leo, Larry whispered, and Leo answered immediately.
She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her.
Shall I call you Joe? Larry asked doubtfully.
No.
There was a note of pleading in the boy's voice.
No, please don't.
You miss your Nadine, Mom, don't you, Leo?
She's dead,
Leo said with chilling simplicity. Is that why you wouldn't talk after she came here? Did you know she was here that day we tried the fishing?
Yes.
It seemed to answer both questions. But you're talking now.
I have you and Lucy, Mom, to talk to.
Yes, of course.
But not for always, the boy said fiercely. Not for always, unless you talk to Franny. Talk to Franny. Talk to Franny.
About Nadine?
No.
About what? About you? Leo's voice rose, became even more shrill.
It's all written down. You know. Franny knows. Talk to Franny.
The committee...
Not the committee. The committee won't help you. It won't help anyone. The committee is the old way. He laughs at your committee because it's the old way, and the old ways are his ways. You know, Franny knows. If you talk together, you can...
Leo brought the ball down hard. Thuck! And it rose higher than his head and came down and rolled away. Larry watched it, his mouth dry, his heart thudding nastily in his chest.
I dropped my ball, Leo said. And ran to go get it.
Larry sat watching him. Franny, he thought. The two of them sat on the edge of the bandshell stage, their feet dangling. It was an hour before dark, and a few people were walking through the park, some of them holding hands. The children's hour is also the lover's hour, Fran thought disjointedly. Larry had just finished telling her everything Leo had said in his trance, and her mind was whirling with it. "So, what do you think?" Larry asked.
"I don't know what to think," she said softly, "except I don't like any of the things that have been happening. Visionary dreams, an old woman who's the voice of God for a while and then walks off into the wilderness, now a little boy who seems to be a telepath. It's like life in a fairy tale. Sometimes I think the superflu left us alive but drove us all mad."
"He said I should talk to you, so I am."
"Written down," Fran said.
"He was right, that kid. That's the whole root of the problem, I think. If I hadn't been so stupid, so conceited as to write it all down... Oh, God damn me!"
Larry stared at her, amazed. "What are you talking about?" So she told him. Beginning with the day in June that Harold had driven into the driveway of her Agunquit home in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac. As she talked, the last bright daylight changed to a bluish shade. The lovers in the park began to drift away. A thin rind of moon rose. In the high-rise condominium on the far side of Canyon Boulevard, a few Coleman gas lamps had come on. She told him about the sign on the barn roof and how she had been sleeping when Harold risked his life to put her name on the bottom. About meeting Stu and Fabian, about Harold's shrill get-away-from-my-bone reaction to Stu. She told him about her diary and about the thumbprint in it.
By the time she finished, it was past 9 o'clock and the crickets were singing. A silence fell between them, and Fran waited apprehensively for Larry to break it. But he seemed lost in thought. At last he said, "How sure are you about that fingerprint? In your own mind, are you positive it was Harold's?" "I knew it was Harold's print the first time I saw it." "That barn he put the sign on," Larry said. "You remember the night I met you, I said I'd been up in it, and that Harold had carved his initials on a beam in the loft?" "Yes." "It wasn't just his initials. It was yours, too. In a heart. The kind of thing a lovesick little boy would do on his school desk." She put her hands over her eyes and wiped them. "What a mess," she said huskily. "You're not responsible for Harold Lauder's actions, Keed." He took her hand in both of his and held it tightly. He looked at her. "Take it from me, the original dipstick, oil slick, and drippy dick. You can't hold it against yourself, because if you do..." His grip tightened to a degree where it became painful, but his voice remained soft. "If you do, you really will go mad. It's hard enough for a person to keep their own socks pulled up, let alone someone else's." He took his hand away, and they were quiet for a time. "You think Harold bears Stu a killing grudge?" he said at last. "You really think it's that deep?" "Yes," she said, "maybe the whole committee, but I don't know what..." His hand fell on her shoulder, stilling her. In the darkness, his posture had changed, his eyes had widened. His lips moved soundlessly. "Larry, what..." "When he went downstairs," Larry muttered, "he went down to get a corkscrew or something." "What?" He turned toward her slowly, as if his head was on a rusty hinge. "You know," he said, "there just might be a way to resolve all this. I don't guarantee it because I didn't look in the book, but... oh, it makes such beautiful sense. Harold reads your diary and not only gets an earful, but an idea. All the best writers kept journals, didn't they?" "Are you saying Harold's got a diary?" "When he went down to the basement the day I brought the wine, I was looking around his living room. He said he was going to put in some chrome and leather, and I was trying to figure out how it would look. And I noticed this loose stone on the hearth..." "Yes!" she bellowed so loudly that he jumped. "The day I snuck in and Nadine Cross came, I sat on the hearth. I remember that loose stone." She looked at Larry again. "There it is again. As if something had us by the nose, was leading us to it." "Coincidence," he said, but he sounded uneasy. "Is it? We were both in Harold's house. We both noticed the loose stone. And we're both here now. Is it coincidence?" "I don't know. What was under that stone?" "A ledger," he said slowly. "I didn't look in it. At the time, I thought it could just as easily have belonged to the previous owner of the house as to Harold. But if it did, wouldn't Harold have found it? We both noticed the loose stone. So let's say he finds it. Even if the guy who lived there before the flu had filled it up with little secrets... the amount he cheated on his taxes, his sex fantasies about his daughter, I don't know what all. Those secrets wouldn't have been Harold's secrets. Do you see that?" "Yes, but don't interrupt while Inspector Underwood is elucidating, you slip of a girl. So if the secrets weren't Harold's secrets, why would he have put the ledger back under the stone? Harold's journal. Do you think it's still there?" "Maybe. I think we better look and see." "Now?" "Tomorrow. He'll be out with the burial committee, and the dean has been up at the power station afternoons." "All right," she said. "Do you think I should tell Stu about this?" "Why don't we wait? There's no sense stirring things up unless it's something. The book might be gone. It might be nothing but a list of things to do. It might be full of perfectly innocent things. Or it might be in code." "I hadn't thought of that. What will we do if there is something?" "Then I guess we'll have to bring it up before the Free Zone Committee." "Another reason to get it done quickly. We're meeting on September 2nd. The committee will handle it."
"Will it?"
"Yes, I think so," Larry said, but he was also thinking of what Leo had said about the committee. She slipped off the edge of the band shell and onto the ground. Thanks for being here, Larry. Where should we meet? The little park across from Harold's. What about there at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? Fine, Larry said. I'll see you then. Franny went home feeling lighter at heart than she had for weeks. As Larry said, the alternatives were now fairly clear. The ledger might prove all of their fears groundless. If it was otherwise, let the committee decide. As Larry had reminded her, they were meeting on the evening of the 2nd at Nick's and Ralph's place, out near the end of Baseline Road. The 1st of September dawned gray and rainy, a dull, forgettable day, but one that no resident of the Free Zone ever forgot. That was the day the power came back on in North Boulder, briefly at least. At 10 to noon in the control room of the power station, Brad Kitchener looked at Stu, Nick, Ralph, and Jack Jackson, who were all standing behind him. Brad smiled nervously and said, "Hail Mary, full of grace." He yanked two big switches down hard. In the huge and cavernous hall below them, two trial generators began to whine. The five men walked over to the wall-to-wall polarized glass window and looked below to where almost 100 men and women stood, all of them wearing protective goggles as per Brad's order. "If we did something wrong, I'd rather blow 2 than 52," Brad had told them earlier. The generators began to whine more loudly. Nick elbowed Stu and pointed to the office ceiling. Stu looked up and began to grin. Behind the translucent panels, the fluorescence had begun to glow weakly. The generators cycled up and up, reaching a high, steady hum, and leveled off. Down below, the crowd of assembled workers broke into spontaneous applause, some of them wincing as they did so. Their hands were raw and flayed from wrapping copper wire hour after drudging hour. The fluorescents were shining brightly and normally now. For Nick, the feeling was the exact opposite of the dread he had known when the lights went out in Shoyo, not one of entombment now, but of resurrection. The two generators supplied power to one small section of North Boulder in the North Street area. There were people in the area who hadn't known about the test that morning, and many of these people fled as if all the devils of hell were after them. TV sets went on in blares of snow. In a house on Spruce Street, a blender whirred into life, trying to blend a cheese and egg mixture that had congealed long since. The blender's motor soon overloaded and blew out. A power saw whined into life in a deserted garage, puffing sawdust out of its guts. Stove burners began to glow. Marvin Gaye began to sing from the loudspeakers of an oldies record shop called the Wax Museum. The words, backed by a steady disco beat, sounded like a dream of the past come to life. "Let's dance, let's shout, get funky what it's all about. Let's dance, let's shout." A power transformer blew on Maple Street and a gaudy spiral of purple sparks drifted down, lit on the wet grass, and went out. At the power station, one of the generators began to whine at a higher, more desperate note. It began to smoke. People backed away, poised just below the point of panic. The place began to fill with the sickish, sweet smell of ozone. A buzzer went off stridently. "Too high!" Brad roared. "Bastards crossing over! Overloading!" He scrambled across the room and slammed both switches back up. The whine of the generators began to die, but not before there was a loud pop and screams, deadened by the safety glass, from below. "Holy crow!" Ralph said. "One of them's on fire!" Above them, the fluorescence faded to sullen cores of white light, then went out completely. Brad jerked open the control room door and came out on the landing. His words echoed flatly in the big open space. "Get the foam to that! Hustle!" Several foam extinguishers were turned on the generator, and the fire was doused. The smell of ozone still hung on the air. The others crowded out on the landing beside Brad. Stu laid a hand on his shoulder. "I'm sorry it turned out the way it did, man," he said. Brad turned toward him, grinning. "Sorry for what?" "Well, it caught a fire, didn't it?" Jack asked. "It surely did. And somewhere around North Street, there's a transformer all blown to shit. We forgot, goddammit, we forgot. They got sick, they died, but they didn't go around turning off their electrical appliances before they did it. There are TVs on, and ovens, and electric blankets all over Boulder. Hell of a power drain. These generators, they're built to cross over when the load's heavy in one place and light in another. That one tried there to cross over, but all the others were shut down, see?"
"If you say so,"
Ralph said doubtfully. Take my word for it, Brad said. We've got the job to do all over again, but only on that one motor. We'll be in business. But... Brad had begun to snap his fingers in an unconscious gesture of excitement. We don't dare turn the juice on till we're sure. Can we get another work crew, a dozen guys or so?
Sure, I guess so, Stu said. What for?
A turning off crew. Just a bunch of guys to go around Boulder and turn off everything that was left on. We don't dare turn the juice back on until that gets done. We've got no fire department, man.
Brad laughed a little crazily.
We're having a free zone committee meeting tomorrow night, Stu said. You come on over and explain why you want them, and you'll get your men. But are you sure that overload won't happen again?
Pretty damn sure, yeah. It wouldn't have happened today if there hadn't been so much stuff left on.
Speaking of that, somebody ought to go over to North Boulder and see if it's burning down.
Nobody was sure if Brad was joking or not. As it turned out, there were several small fires, mostly from hot appliances. None of them spread in the drizzle that was falling. And what people in the zone remembered later about the 1st of September 1980 was that it was the day the power came back on, if only for 30 seconds or so. An hour later, Fran met Larry at Eben G. Fine Park across from Harold's.
See, you rode a bike too, Larry said.
She nodded.
Quieter.
I stowed mine out of sight in that shelter.
He nodded to an open-walled, low-roofed building by the playground.
Franny trundled her bike between the swings and the slide and into the shelter. The odor inside was musty and fetid. The place had been a make-out spot for kids too young to drive, she guessed. It was littered with beer bottles and cigarette ads. There was a crumpled pair of panties in the far corner and the remains of a small fire in the near one. She parked her bike next to Larry's and came back outside quickly. In those shadows, with the scent of that long-dead sex musk in her nose, it was too easy to imagine the dark man standing just behind her, his twisted coat hanger in hand.
Regular Holiday Inn, isn't it? Larry said dryly.
Not my idea of pleasant accommodations, Fran said with a little shiver. No matter what comes of this, Larry, I want to tell Stu everything tonight.
Larry nodded.
Yeah, not just because he's on the committee. He's also the marshal.
Fran looked at him, troubled. Really, for the first time, she understood that this expedition might end with Harold in jail. They were going to sneak into his house without a warrant or anything and poke around.
Oh, bad, she said.
Not too good, is it?
He agreed.
You want to call it off?
She thought for a long time and then shook her head.
Good. I think we ought to know one way or the other.
Are you sure they're both gone?
Yes. I saw Harold driving one of the burial committee trucks early this morning, and all the people who were on the power committee were invited over for the tryout.
You sure she went?
It'd look damn funny if she didn't, wouldn't it?
Fran thought that over and then nodded.
I guess it would. By the way, Stu said they hope to have most of the town electrified again by the 6th.
That's going to be a mighty day, Larry said, and thought how nice it would be to sit down in Shannon's or the Broken Drum with a big Fender guitar and an even bigger amp and play something, anything, as long as it was simple and had a heavy beat, at full volume. Gloria, maybe, or Walkin' the Dog. Just about anything, in fact, except Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?
Come on, Fran said. Let's go.
Steady hard rapping at first the front and then the back door convinced them that Harold's house was indeed empty.
How did you get in? Larry asked.
The cellar window.
They went around to the side of the house, and Larry pulled and tugged fruitlessly at the window while Fran kept watch.
Maybe you did, he said, but it's locked now.
No, it's just sticking. Let me try.
But she had no better luck. Sometime between her first clandestine trip out here and now, Harold had locked up tight.
What do we do now? She asked.
Let's break it.
Larry, he'll see it.
Let him. If he doesn't have anything to hide, he'll think it was just kids or something. If he does have something to hide, it'll worry him plenty, and he deserves to be worried, right?
She looked doubtful, but didn't stop him as he took off his shirt, wrapped it around his fist and forearm, and crunched the basement window. Glass tinkled inward, and he felt around for the catch.
Here it is.
He released it, and the window slid back. Larry slipped through and turned to help her.
Be careful, kiddo. No miscarriages in Harold Lauder's basement, please.
He caught her under the arms and eased her down. They stood around the rumpus room together. The croquet set stood sentinel. The air hockey table was littered with little snips of colored electrical wire. "What's this?" she said, picking up a piece of it. "This wasn't here before." He shrugged. "Maybe Harold's building the better mousetrap." There was a box under the table, and he fished it out. The cover said, "Deluxe Realistic Walkie-Talkie Set." Larry opened the box, but the heft of it had already told him it was empty. "Building walkie-talkies instead of mousetraps," Fran said. "No, this wasn't a kit. You buy this kind ready to go. Maybe he was modifying them somehow." "Sounds like Harold. Remember how Stu bitched about the walkie-talkie reception when he and Harold and Ralph were out hunting for Mother Abigail?" She nodded, but there was still something about those snips of wire that bothered her. They went up the stairs, but this time the door at the top was locked. She looked at him, and Larry shrugged. "We've come this far, right?" Fran nodded. Larry bumped his shoulder against the door a few times to get the feel of the bolt on the other side, and then rammed it hard. There was a snapping metal sound, a clunk, and the door swung open. Larry bent and picked up a bolt assembly from the linoleum kitchen floor. "I can put this back on, and he'll never know the difference. That is, if there's a screwdriver handy." "Why bother? He's going to see the broken window." "That's true. But if the bolt's back on the door, he'll..." "What are you smiling about?" "Put the bolt back on by all means. But how are you going to draw it from the cellar side of the door?" He thought about it and said, "Geez, I hate a smart-ass woman worse than anything." He tossed the bolt onto the Formica kitchen counter. "Let's go look under that hearthstone." They went into the shadowy living room, and Fran felt anxiety start to creep up. Last time, Nadine hadn't had a key. This time, if she came back, she would have. And if she did come back, they would be caught red-handed. It would be a bitter joke if Stu's first job as marshal turned out to be arresting his own woman for breaking and entering. "That's it, isn't it?" Larry asked, pointing. "Yes, be as quick as you can." "There's a good chance he's moved it anyway." And Harold had. It was Nadine who had replaced it under the loose hearthstone. When Larry pulled the loose hearthstones aside, it lay there, the word ledger gleaming mellowly up at them in gold-filled letters. They both stared at it. The room seemed suddenly hotter, stuffier, darker. "Well," Larry said, "are we going to admire it or read it?" "You," Fran said, "I don't even want to touch it." Larry picked it out of the hole and automatically wiped the white stone dust from the cover. He began to flip through it at random. The writing had been done with a felt-tipped marker of the sort that had been marketed under the pugnacious brand name Hardhead. It had allowed Harold to write in a tiny, perfect script, the handwriting of an intensely conscientious man, perhaps a driven man. There were no paragraph breaks. There was only an eyelash of a margin to the right and left, but that margin was constant, so straight that it might have been drawn with a ruler. "It'd take me 3 days to read all this," Larry said. "Hold it," Fran said, and reached over his arm to turn back a couple of pages. Here the steady flow of words was broken by a boldly boxed-off area. What had been enclosed seemed to be some sort of motto. "To follow one's star is to concede the power of some greater force, some providence. Yet is it still not possible that the act of following itself is the taproot of even greater power? Your God, your devil, owns the keys to the lighthouse. I have grappled with that so long and hard in these last 2 months, but to each of us he has given the responsibility of navigation. Harold Emery Lauder." "Sorry," Larry said, "it's by me, you get it?" Fran shook her head slowly. "I guess it's Harold's way of saying following can be as honorable as leading. But as a motto, I don't think it's going to put waste not, want not out of business." Larry continued to flip toward the front of the book, coming upon another 4 or 5 of the boxed maxims, all of them attributed to Harold in capital letters. "Whew," Larry said. "Look at this one, Franny. It is said the two great human sins are pride and hate. Are they? I like to think of them as the two great virtues. To give away pride and hate is to say you will change for the good of the world. To vent them is more noble. That is to say, the world must change for the good of you. I am on a great adventure. Harold Emery Lauder." That's the work of a profoundly disturbed mind, Fran said. She felt cold.
It's the kind of thinking that got us into this mess to start with, Larry agreed. He flipped rapidly to the start of the book. Time's wasting. Let's see what we can make of this.
Neither of them knew exactly what to expect. They had read nothing of the ledger except the boxed mottos and an occasional phrase or two, which, mostly due to Harold's convoluted style, meant little or nothing. What they saw at the ledger's beginning was therefore a complete shock. They read that first sentence, holding the ledger between them like children at a choir practice, and Fran said, "Oh," in a small, strangled voice, and stepped away, her hand pressed lightly to her mouth.
"Fran, we have to take the book," Larry said.
"Yes."
"And show it to Stu. I don't know if Leo's right about them being on the dark man's side, but at the very least, Harold is dangerously disturbed. You can see that."
"Yes," she said again. She felt faint, weak. So this was how the matter of the diaries ended. It was as if she had known. As if she had known it all from the moment she saw that big, smudged thumbprint. And she had to keep telling herself not to faint, not to faint. "Fran? Franny? Are you all right?"
Larry's voice, from far away. The first sentence in Harold's ledger.
"My great pleasure this delightful post-apocalypse summer will be to kill Mr. Stuart Dogcock Redman, and just maybe I will kill her, too."
"Ralph? Ralph Brentner, you home?"
"Hoo-hoo, anybody home?"
She stood on the steps looking at the house. No motorcycles in the yard, only a couple of bikes parked around to one side. Ralph would have heard her, but there was the mute to think about, the deaf mute. You could holler until you were blue, and he wouldn't answer, and still he might be there. Shifting her shopping bag from one arm to the other, Nadine tried the door and found it unlocked. She stepped inside. She was in a small foyer. Four steps went up to the kitchen area, and a flight of them went down to the basement area where Harold said Andros had his apartment. Putting her most pleasant expression on her face, Nadine went downstairs, fixing her excuse in her mind if he should be there.
"I came right in because I didn't think you'd know I was knocking. Some of us wanted to know if there's going to be a late shift wrapping those two motors that blew. Did Brad say anything to you?"
There were only two rooms down there. One of them was a bedroom as simple as a monk's cell. The other was a study. There was a desk, a big chair, a wastebasket, a bookcase. The top of the desk was littered with scraps of paper, and she looked through them idly. Most of them made little sense to her. She guessed they were Nick's side of some conversation. Others seemed to be memos to himself, jottings, thoughts. A few of them reminded her of the boxes in Harold's ledger, what he called his guideposts to a better life, with a sarcastic smile. One read, "Talk to Glenn about trade. Do any of us know how trade starts? Scarcity of goods, isn't it? Or a modified corner on some market? Skills, that may be a key word. What if Brad Kitchener decides to sell instead of giving away? Or the dock? What would we pay with? Another, "Community protection is a two-way street." Another, "Every time we talk about the law, I spend the night having nightmares about Shoyo, watching them die, watching Childress throw his supper around the cell. The law, what do we do about the goddamned law? Capital punishment. Now there's a smiley thought. When Brad gets the power on, how long before someone asks him to rig an electric chair up?" She turned away from the scraps, reluctantly. It was fascinating to look through papers left by a man who could think wholly only by writing. One of her college profs had been fond of saying that the thought process can never be complete without articulation. But her purpose was already completed. Nick was not here. No one was here. To linger over long would be to press her luck unnecessarily. She went back upstairs. Harold had told her they would probably meet in the living room. It was a huge room, carpeted with a thick wine-colored shag rug, dominated by a freestanding fireplace that went up through the roof in a column of rock.
The entire west wall was glass, giving on a magnificent view of the Flatirons. It made her feel as exposed as a bug on a wall. She knew that the outer surface of the glass was iodized, so that anyone outside would see only a mirror-like reflection. But the psychological feeling was still one of utter exposure. She wanted to finish quickly. On the southern side of the room, she found what she was looking for, a deep closet that Ralph hadn't cleaned out. Coats hung far back inside, and in the rear corner there was a tangle of boots and mittens and winter woolens about 3 feet deep. Working quickly, she took the groceries out of her shopping bag. They were camouflage, and there was only a single layer of them. Beneath the cans of tomato paste and sardines was the hush puppy's shoebox. "If I put it in a closet, will it still work?" she had asked. "Won't the extra wall muffle the blast?" "Nadine," Harold had responded, "if that device works, and I have no reason whatever to believe it won't, it will take the house and most of the surrounding hillside. Put it anywhere you think it will be unobserved until their meeting. A closet will be fine. The extra wall will blow out and become shrapnel. I trust your judgment, dear. It's going to be just like the old fairy tale about the tailor and the flies. 7 at a blow." Nadine pushed aside boots and scarves, made a hole, and slipped the shoebox into it. She covered it over again and then worked her way out of the closet. There. Done. For better or for worse. She left the house quickly, not looking back, trying to ignore the voice that wouldn't stay dead. The voice that was now telling her to go back in there and pull the wires that ran between the blasting caps and the walkie-talkie, telling her to give this up before it drove her mad. Because wasn't that what was really lying somewhere up ahead? Now maybe less than 2 weeks ahead? Wasn't madness the final logical conclusion? She slipped the bag of groceries into the Vespa's carrier and kicked the machine into life. And all the time she was driving away, that voice went on. "You're not going to leave that there, are you? You're not going to leave that bomb in there, are you? In a world where so many have died." She leaned into a turn, barely able to see where she was going. Tears had begun to blur her eyes. "The one great sin is to take a human life. 7 lives here. No, more than that. Because the committee was going to hear reports from the heads of several subcommittees." She stopped at the corner of Baseline and Broadway, thinking she would turn around and go back. She was shuddering all over. And later she would never be able to explain to Harold precisely what had happened. In truth, she never even tried. It was a foretaste of the horrors to come. She felt a blackness creeping over her vision. It came like a dark curtain slowly drawn, flipping and flapping in a mild breeze. Every now and then the breeze would gust, the curtain would flap more vigorously, and she would see a bit of daylight under its hem, a little bit of this deserted intersection. But the curtain came over her vision in steady blackout drifts, and soon she was lost in it. She was blind, she was deaf, she was without the sense of touch. The thinking creature, the Nadine ego, drifted in a warm black cocoon like seawater, like amniotic fluid. And she felt him creep inside her. A shriek built up within her, but she had no mouth with which to scream. It was like nothing she had ever felt before. Later, similes occurred to describe it, and she rejected them one by one. You're swimming, and suddenly, in the midst of the warm water, you're treading water in a pocket of deep, numbing cold. You've been given Novocaine, and the dentist pulls a tooth. It comes out with a painless tug. You spit blood into the white enamel basin. There's a hole in you. You've been gouged. You can slip your tongue into the hole where part of you was living a second ago. You stare at your face in the mirror. You stare at it for a long time. 5 minutes, 10, 15. No fair blinking. You watch with an intellectual sort of horror as your face changes, like the face of Lon Chaney Jr. in a werewolf epic. You become a stranger to yourself, an olive-skinned doppelganger, a psychotic vampiro with pale skin and fish-slit eyes. It was really none of those things, but there was a taste trace of all of them. The dark man entered her, and he was cold. She was waiting for Harold around the corner from the bus station. When he saw her, his face froze and drained of color,
Nadine, he whispered. The lunch bucket dropped from his hand and clacked on the pavement. Harold, she said, they know. We've got to... Your hair, Nadine! Oh, my God, your hair! Listen to me! He seemed to gain some of himself back. All right, what? They went up to your house and found your book. They took it away. Emotions at war on Harold's face. Anger, horror, shame. Little by little they drained away, and then, like some terrible corpse coming up from deep water, a frozen grin resurfaced on Harold's face. Who? I'm not sure. Fran Goldsmith was one of them, I'm sure of that. Maybe Bateman or Underwood, I don't know. But they'll come for you, Harold. How do you know? He grabbed her roughly by the shoulders, remembering that she had put the ledger back under the hearthstone. He shook her like a rag doll, but Nadine faced him without fear. She had been face to face with more terrible things than Harold Lauder on this long, long day. You bitch, how do you know? He told me. Harold's hands dropped away. Flag? A whisper. He told you what to do? He spoke to you? And it did that? Harold's grin was ghastly, the grin of the reaper on horseback. What are you talking about? They were standing next to an appliance store. Taking her by the shoulders again, Harold turned her to face the glass. Nadine looked at her reflection for a long time. Her hair had gone white, entirely white. There was not a single black strand left. Come on, she said, we have to leave town. Now? After dark. We'll hide until then and pick up what camping gear we need on the way out. West? Not yet. Not until tomorrow night. Maybe I don't want to anymore, Harold whispered. He was still looking at her hair. She put his hand on it. Too late, Harold, she said.